given solid support by evidence from all sides of the question. Still, every once in a while, something would happen to remind her that although all animals were equally intelligent, some were more equal than others. In grasping the import of a new situation, humans were sometimes quicker on the uptake than some of their brethren. Sometimes. In this case, maybe it helped that she knew she was flying in an airship that had just pointed its bow up at the sky. These poor, but dangerous, bears might not even be aware they were flying, so such a tilt could have been very disorienting indeed. But who knew? Also, some of them might have fallen only onto the back wall of the bridge, and thus still be up there. It seemed quite possible, but there was no way of knowing without going to look. And what if she did that and found them there? She wasn't sure what she would do about that. Gritting her teeth, holding her breath, flushing hot all over her skin, she opened the utility closet door a tiny bit and took a look down the hall, ready to slam the door again if she had to. Her view was restricted sternward, thus down, and indeed, she could see bears, looking like big people in white fur coats, down there sitting on the back wall of their enclosure. One was on his back. Another was sitting and sniffing the air curiously, very like a dog. A couple more were tangled in a mass, like wrestlers, both of whom had lost. They were inside their room and apparently had descended through its open door, which was still open, having flopped all the way open against the wall. A lucky thing. This was encouraging, but it left two bears unaccounted for. These might have fallen only as far as the stern wall of the bridge, and thus still be where she needed to go. Also, if she were to go out into the hall, it was not immediately obvious why she too would not slide down the hall and join the bears in their room. That would be bad. If she managed to slide down there and then stop herself, close their door and lock them in, that would be good, up to a point. But if there were two more bears still on the loose, now locked out of their room, that would be bad. There seemed more bad than good out there, but she couldn't stay where she was forever. Somehow, she had to take advantage of the situation while it lasted. She wasn't sure how long the assisted migration could stay standing on its tail. It seemed awkward and un-aerodynamic to her. She had not even known it could do it without falling. Like she was going to, if she didn't watch out. This gave her the idea of making herself into a little airship within the airship. At first, she couldn't figure out how to access any of the helium on board, nor how to calculate how much of it she would need to float herself up to the bow. But it turned out there was a tall helium canister in the jumble on the bottom of the tool closet with her. Some kind of emergency supply, perhaps to top off a ballonet with a micro leak or something like that. Rooting around, she also found a roll of large plastic trash bags, with ties around the open ends. If some of these bags were filled with helium, perhaps double or triple bagged, and the open ends tied shut, and all of them tied together by a cord tied to her so that the open ends were kept at the bottom of the now floating bags, then presumably the bags would hold the helium like party balloons, at least for a while, and loft her. She was checking the valve on the canister of helium and getting the bags doubled inside each other when her closet door slammed shut on her with a huge bang, scaring her terribly. Some dim memory of the Hindenburg disaster must stay lodged in the unconscious minds of anyone flying in an airship, such that loud noises are unwelcome. On reflection, she decided that another bear must have slid down the hallway onto his or her fellow bears. That was good, although it left one unaccounted for. This was a worry, but she couldn't stay in the closet forever, so now seemed her best chance. She filled four trash bags with helium and pushed them out into the hallway on the cord she had tied around their open ends. they worked like she hoped they would, tugging her up toward the bridge. Four didn't seem enough, though. She let out more cord for the ones already filled, tugged down to test their lift, then sat down and filled four more bags. It seemed like a lot of helium, and enough of it was getting loose in the closet that she was beginning to feel a little yucky. "We're off to see the wizard," she sang. And yes, her voice was munchkinly high. It would be funny if she weren't worried about blacking out. It was time to test her method before she inadvertently killed herself, which gave her the idea of knocking out the bear on the bridge by filling the bridge with helium for a very short interval. Problems with that plan reared their heads, and there was a tranquilizer dart gun still with her in the closet she could find and reload and take with her. So she decided to stick with the plan of floating up to the bridge to see what was going on. But, oh yeah, important to get her camera headband on and turn it on to record for the show or for posterity. "We're off to see the wizard," she sang again, just as high, if not higher. And in that same munchkin voice, she began to narrate her ascent to the bridge. "Here we go, folks. I'm going to let these bags of helium carry me up to the bridge, and I have a tranquilizer dart gun that I can use to deal with any bear that might be stuck up there. I think one is not yet accounted for, who is probably up there. I'll catch you up on all that later. For now, I'd better get out of this room, as you can hear. I definitely feel a little lightheaded. I hope that will lift me once I get out this door." She wrapped the lines around her belt and held them tight in her left hand, felt the upward tug of the trash bags, and launched herself out of the closet into the hall. The polar bears down in their room stared up at her, surprised, and one tried to stand. And in fact, now that she was fully suspended from the bags and hanging freely in the hallway, she found herself drifting slightly downward toward the bears. It felt like a couple more bags would have given her the buoyancy she needed, but no time for that now. She wedged herself in the 90-degree angle between floor and wall, squeaking, "Oh no, oh no!" She put one foot against floor, one against wall, as if stemming up what climbers would call an open book crack. The airship was not totally vertical, so she had a steep but climbable V-slope to wedge into. She had only done a little climbing in her life, always following the lead of her old boyfriend, Elrond, and she couldn't remember if open book cracks were usually more or less than 90 degrees open. Anyway, this was what she had to work with. So she pressed outward hard with both feet and clawed with the fingers on her right hand in the crack itself, while holding the lines to the trash bags above her and as far into the crack as she could, so that they would loft her upward without pulling her away from her hold. These moves seemed to stabilize her, and after that, she found that she could, with care, stem up the hallway toward the bridge. The fact that it was not completely vertical was key, and as soon as she realized that, she felt that the airship was going even more vertical than it had before. "Oh no," she said again, but at least it was in her own voice. The air felt good. "Franz, stop it. Hold your angle." She clawed the floor with her fingernails and pressed outward with her toes and stepped with teeny steps up toward the bridge. The helium bags definitely helped. It was possible she was only a few pounds from neutral buoyancy. She slipped once or twice along the way, causing her to exclaim, "Oh no," and sweat. But luckily, her head camera was pointed up at the balloon bags, and she would not be doing any selfies until she got onto a better platform, no matter how much Nicole lectured her about it afterward. The footage she was getting now, which included her hands for sure, would tell the tale more vividly than any selfie. Although it occurred to her that Nicole would have asked her to use some cam drones. She could even have sent them up to do reconnaissance on the bridge. But in fact, they were on the bridge now, in a cabinet. So, whatever. She was on her way. Although it took a while, she eventually found herself at the doorway to the bridge. now looking like a square hole leading up into an attic. She had to move the lines around without dislodging herself to let all the helium bags up through the door into the space of the bridge. Then she could scrabble up the last part of the hall until she could grab the door's handle, hanging down toward her, after which she was able to pull herself halfway into the room she had been hoping to reach for the last 30 hours. "I made it," she told her future audience. Then she saw the last of the polar bears, a female, it appeared, lying on the stern wall of the bridge, looking confused and unhappy. "Oh," Amelia said to it. "Hi. Hi, bear. Stay right there." This inadvertent little nursery rhyme inspired her to make a kind of Peter Pan lifted by wires move up into the bridge, pulling hard on the door jamb to launch herself upward while she also tugged the tranquilizer dart gun out of her belt. She came within a few pounds per square inch of shooting herself in the belly, but did not. When she cleared the door, she toed the floor and leaped upward, and the bags helped make it quite a balletic move, almost too much so, as the bags ran into the glass front wall and she soared into the bags and then started to fall back down, back toward the bear, who was rising on her haunches with an investigative, or at least troubled, expression. So Amelia, without the slightest reluctance, shot the bear in the shoulder, then again in the chest. Then she landed on the back wall, right next to it. It was looking at the dart in its chest unhappily. It brushed it off, then growled loudly, so loudly that Amelia instinctively jumped up again and got another surprising helium assist, afterward flailing a bit as she pendulumed around the air of the room right above the bear, who waved at her woozily. Then the bear grew content to lie down and sleep it off, and Amelia avoided plunging through the open door to the hall by way of some deft footwork, after which she landed and sat there on the back wall beside the open door, now like a trapdoor to doom, hyperventilating. Oh, my God! When the bear seemed to be really out, Amelia asked Franz to right the ship. Then she thought it over and countermanded that request, and approached the drugged bear's side to see if she could move her to the doorway and let her slide senselessly down the hall to her proper quarters. But she couldn't move the bear. Not at all. The bear was a big, heavy lump, like a sleeping dog that knew where it wanted to sleep and wouldn't be budged even when unconscious. Even a dog could do that with Amelia, and this bear weighed about 700 pounds. "If I had a lever, I could move the bear," Amelia said aloud. This caused her to remember that there was a come-along in the tool closet. But that was no help now. "Here, Franz," she said, looking at the bridge carefully. "Bring yourself around in the air so that the bear will slide toward the bridge door. Do you see what I mean?"
"No."
Amelia had to think out the directions, then tell Franz which way to tilt. She herself was not much better at it than the autopilot, and it took some experimenting. But eventually, she got the airship tilting the right way, and the comatose bear slid toward the doorway, now a kind of trapdoor. When it was close to the edge, Amelia used a broom as a crowbar and levered the bear into the doorway. Prepared for this moment, Amelia ordered Franz to shift more off the vertical at the same moment the bear rolled into the hole, and it seemed like Franz tilted fast enough that when the bear hit the stern end of the wall, it was more sliding than falling. Then it plopped through the doorway, down there into the bear's quarters. "Now I have to close the door," Amelia cried. And she jumped through the doorway, still holding the bags of helium, and lofted down the hallway like a parachutist. Kind of, until she thumped down next to the doorway to the bear's quarters, just narrowly avoiding a drop right through the open door that would have had her joining the bears. Not good. But by spread-eagling, she did avoid it. And quickly she closed and locked the enclosure door. "Franz, right the ship," she said triumphantly, and then killed the cameras and crawled up to the bathroom to pee. Yay!
People born and bred to life within earshot and eye glance of a score of neighbors have learned to preserve their own private worlds by uniformly ignoring each other, except on direct invitation. John Michael Hayes and Cornell Woolrich, Rear Window.
E. Inspector Jen. Inspector Jen walked the skyways to work. Breezy fall day. Autumn in New York, the great song of the city. Wave tank patterns diamonding the canals below, lit from the south by the low morning sun. Her favorite time of year. Have to get out the heavier jacket. In the station, it was the usual scurrying about, the blunt edge of pandemonium. How could there be crime on a day so beautiful? So many different kinds of hunger, desperate eyes in a blank face, hands manacled, chain around waist. Ah, the waist. Hold the line. She went into her office and sat down behind her desk. She kept the desktop clear, the only way to keep it from being inundated. She picked up the single note on the battered blotter and saw that her chief assistant, Lieutenant Claire Clooney, wanted a meeting with her and Sergeant Olmsted. She was about to call Claire when a ruckus erupted outside her door. She took a look, and there was that same blank face, now pulled back into a rictus of despair and rage, teeth exposed, foaming at the mouth. Striking out wildly, three big street cops trying to subdue the person. Jen wasn't sure about gender here. Cuffing behind the back was always safer, even with wrists shackled to waist. It was a lesson that somehow did not become policy. She didn't know why. "What's the problem?" she asked the demented prisoner. Gargled gasp, hissing, more foam from mouth. Drug reaction, it seemed. Jen winced as the cuffed hands together swung into the ribs of one of the cops. Would leave a bruise. But the cop hooked an arm through the arms of the afflicted person and simply lifted the person bodily off feet. Struggle availed nothing, and a wickedly fast attempt to bite only bit a thrust hat, stunning the prisoner. The others pressed in, and a taser shot arched the prisoner back and into a wrap held out by another cop. The wrap was like an armless straitjacket. Off they carried the person. "To the hospital," Jen said. But of course they were already headed that way, and only nodded before disappearing down the hall. Bellevue was conveniently nearby. "Does anyone know what that was about?" Jen called to those down the hall, minding other business. "Bad shit in Kipps Bay," Sergeant Fripp said. "This is the third one today." Oh, hell. Bad drugs were always the bane of the city, right back to the demon rum. She never saw the point. To her, anything beyond a beer was illness, if not hell. Here it was 8 a.m. on a fine, breezy morning. Poor person foaming at the mouth. People were strange. Do we know where they got it? "Looks like the Park 33 area. Someone said Mesro's." "Really?" "That's what she said." "That's not like them." "No, it isn't." Jen thought it over. "I guess I should go and have a word with them, see what's up." "It isn't like them. Do you want any of us along?" "I'll take Claire and Ezra." As if called, Claire showed up, Olmsted in hand. When they were seated, Jen regarded her whiteboard unenthusiastically. The big screen on the other wall, filled with a live GIS map of the city marked by various kinds of tags, was just as uninspiring. When they got to it, near the end of a long list of outstanding problems, Claire reported there were still no pings from the two men who had gone missing out of the old Met Tower. Quite possibly, they were dead. On the other hand, among bodies found recently, none had been them. Possibly they had slipped away and were hiding for some reason. Possibly someone had kidnapped them. Either would be odd, but odd things definitely happened. People were well documented these days, not in any single system, but in the stack of all systems, the accidental mega system. It was hard to stay hidden. but it wasn't a total system in the end, so it could happen. Olmsted brought her up to date on what he had found in the data sphere, and Jen drew things on the whiteboard just to help her see. Initials, X's and O's, arrows here and there, lines solid or dotted. The two men's contract work for Henry Vincent's hedge fund Alban Albany had ended just 3 months earlier. Alban Albany, like most hedge funds, kept its financial activities proprietarial. But Sean had found signs that it was involved in high-frequency trading in the dark pools run out of the Cloister cluster. Vincent's earlier work for Adirondack Investing, when he'd worked with Larry Jackman, had done that kind of trading, and Rosen and Muttchopf had worked for Adirondack, too. Adirondack had been one of the investment firms the Senate Finance Committee was looking at when Rosen had recused himself. Rosen and Muttchopf's recent work for Alban Albany had gotten them paid $40,000 apiece. Then they'd left and started moving around. Vincent's business security and his personal security were both handled by a security firm called Pincher Pinkerton, an international firm based in Grand Cayman, if anywhere. Very opaque, Olmsted said gloomily, even though its name was out there as one of the free-floating armies for hire that were now roaming at large in the world. An octopus, as subsidiary-stacked corporations were called. Or, more probably, an arm of a bigger octopus. On the night Rosen and Muttchopf had disappeared, Sean said there had been a strange event in the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. A bite across everything in the exchange, after which everything went back to normal. Along with the bite, there had been a bolus of information sent to the SEC that the SEC wasn't talking about. No obvious connection to the two men, except that it had happened that night. It'd be good to get the SEC to tell us what they got that night. I'm trying, Olmsted said. They're slow. That was all they had that was new on that case. Olmsted had also, at Jen's behest, been looking into the bid on the Met Tower that had so troubled Charlotte. So far, he had only managed to confirm that it was being laundered through the big brokerage Morningside Realty, headquartered uptown, but doing business all over the tri-state region. Jen marked up with her whiteboard. Findings about the two men were in red. The Met Tower was a blue box with Charlotte Armstrong on one side of it and Vlade Maravich on the other. She noodled around on the board for a while, trying out scenarios. They needed to find out what Vincent's hedge fund was doing and whether it was perhaps behind the broker making the bid on the Met. Needed to investigate all Vlade's employees in the Met. It was a relief to think that neither Charlotte nor Vlade had a good reason to be involved in the disappearance, but Jen was suspicious of her relief. Feelings like that caused one to miss things. On the other hand, it was an intuitive business. Suppose the two missing men had dived into Alban Albany's dark pool while they were working there, then set up the access needed to make the flashbite in the CME. That might explain the quick response suggested by their disappearance on the same night. In high-frequency trading terms, an hour was like a decade. Or, suppose Vincent was behind Morningside's offer on the building, and Rosen and Muttchopf had found out about it, or somehow interfered with it. Might be standard at Alban Albany to stovepipe any corporate decisions on Rosen directly to Vincent. Might be his people had instructions to keep an eye on the boss's cousin. A black sheep patrol, that was called. Many families had to have them, including families in the NYPD. As she noodled away randomly at the whiteboard, Sean and Claire regarded her fondly. The inspector was so old school. To her young assistants, it was partly cute but partly impressive, in a mysterious and possibly even frustrating way. She often got results from this whiteboard maundering, useless though it appeared. Although from time to time, Sean would shake his head, even raise his hand, This is exactly what it isn't, he would complain. It isn't a diagram. It isn't mappable. You're confusing yourself with this stuff here. A thread through the maze, she would reply. The maze was always four dimensions. But think six dimensions, Sean would suggest. And she would shake her head. There's only four dimensions, youth. Try to keep your head on. And he would shake his head. So old school, his look would say. Only four dimensions when there are clearly six? Which Jen would refuse to ask him about. She didn't want those two extra dimensions, so clearly fictional, explained to her. Let the youth navigate that realm. Now she asked them what they had managed to dig up on the Black Sheep front. The two cousins apparently had lived in the same house for a time after Jeff's childhood home got inundated in the second pulse. This might have led to fraternal feelings or to lifelong hatred. 50-50 on that, but only after starting with another 50-50 split as to whether the cohabitation had produced strong emotions or complete indifference. But even that suggested a 25% chance that later on, Vincent would be keeping tabs on his black sheep coder cuz. And yet, he had hired him twice for jobs. One of these hires, well after Rosen had recused himself while Vincent was being investigated. Keep your friends close, your enemies closer. Keep the black sheep in the pen. Then comes a flash bite on the CME. Trust among traders, easy to lose, hard to regain. So put the black sheep out to pasture, somewhere far away. Too many theories, not enough data, she said, at which observation her assistants looked relieved. But she had a sense that the explanation might be somewhere on the whiteboard, no matter Olmsted's objections. Garbled, no doubt, but the players were there, maybe. If it was a case that made sense, sometimes they just didn't. See if you can crack Morningside Realty's confidentiality. Olmsted wrinkled his nose. Hard without a warrant. We won't get one. See if you can suborn someone there. Her assistants snorted in tandem. Come on, she protested. Are you NYPD or not? They looked at her like they didn't even know what that meant. She sniffed at them. Might have to find out some of these things by herself. On the side. Use her Bacino irregulars. Or her friends in the feds. Or both. People still living in 3D. Off the two youngsters went. Soon it would be lunchtime. Her to-do list was barely dented. Eat at the desk. As so often. Then she worked. Departmental biz. Wasted hours. Then it was almost four, and she decided it would indeed be good to visit her friends at Mesro's. Time to go native. Dive back down into the deep depths of home. For she too had once been the black sheep of a family. Lieutenant Claire joined her down on the narrow, long dock outside their building on 21st, and they waited for Sergeant Fripp to show up in his cruiser, a narrow hydrofoil, standard now as the water police's usual speedster. You really want to go there again? Fripp asked as they boarded. White teeth and black beard. Ezra Fripp liked going to Mesro's, or anywhere else that put him on or under the water, poking at the chaos. Jen's cynicism about the amphibious and their speakeasies and bathhouses had hardened in recent years. Too many things had changed, too many crimes committed. But she could reach down to that kernel of nostalgia for the old days if she tried hard enough. Yes, she told Fripp. Fripp purred up 2nd to 33rd, turned west, and glided to a halt near the old subway station. The intersections were crowded with boats following the old adage, take turns when taking turns. The narrow dock on the west side was full, but police had some of its ancient prerogatives still, and Ezra nosed in without being too obnoxious about it, but without wasting too much time either. He tied off the painter to a dock cleat, and they hopped up, leaving the speedster guarded by a drone cop. On the north end of the dock, they dropped down stairs in a big tilted graphinated tube that descended at a 45-degree angle into the submarine warren that had once been a subway station. The speakeasy door at the bottom of the stairs was in the classic style, and Jen rapped on it, using the old code for the submarine gang she had been part of over in Hoboken 30 years before. An eye appeared in the Judas window, and after a moment, the door opened, and they were escorted in. "Ellie is expecting me," Jen said to the doorman, which was not true, except in the sense that it was permanently true. She and Ellie went back forever. Soon Ellie showed up and waved them into a back room, which was dominated by an ancient but immaculate pool table with booths against the walls. Lights were dim, booths were empty. It was early for Ellie's place. "Have a seat," Ellie said. "What brings you here? Want anything?" "Water," Jen said, to be annoying. Ezra and Claire asked about using the pool table, and when Ellie nodded, they set to, clacking the balls around the table without much sign of dropping them in pockets. Ellie sat down at her corner table, and Jen joined her. "So," Ellie said. She was still very stylish. Swedish and so white blonde she was rumored to be albino, which many submarine people of color found funny in the redundant or how-can-you-tell category of jokes. 5'9", 120 pounds, well-distributed what little there was of her. Glamorous. She stretched her fingers on the table as if to display them. Always she made an attempt to overawe Jen with her etched, pale beauty, and Jen had to allow that it took an effort to keep this from working. Of course it was easy to stay slim on the little thread of fentanyl Ellie was on. Easy to stay relaxed. Jen knew all that, and yet it was still hard not to feel a little frumpy. Like a cop. Like a big, black, female cop wedded to her job. Ebony and ivory. Chess queens black and white. The supermodel and the glump. The capo and the copette. On and on it went. But mainly old friends gone separate ways. That was the way it had been for many years, and knowing Ellie was here meant Jen knew what was going on underwater. She knew that the dealing that got done here was small time, like regular businesses, at least compared to what could have been. Taking care of the amphibious ones meant knowing who was bringing in what to where, and developing relationships, and using the relationships when possible. This was true for both of them. "I heard there's bad stuff getting sold in Kipps Bay," Jen said, "and I came over to check it out. It didn't seem like you. I didn't believe it." Ellie frowned. This was too direct, as Jen well knew. But it was time to forego gossip about new submarine fashions and such. Ellie finished pouting at this brushback fastball, then said, "I know what you mean, Jen, but it isn't any of us. You know I wouldn't allow that." "So who is it?" Ellie shrugged, looked around the room. The room was in a Faraday box with a magnetic charge that would scramble any recorders, and Jen didn't have one anyway. No recorder, no body cam. It was all part of the protocol between them. Talk here rather than down at the station, etc. Jen nodded to confirm this, and Ellie leaned forward and said, "There's a group from uptown putting this shit out, I think, to try to wreck the feel down here. It's so stupid, I think it must be on purpose. We lost someone last week. So now I've pulled everyone in and put them on alert. Keep an eye out for strangers and the like." "Who is it?" "I still don't know. And it's interesting how hard it is to find out. No one underwater will say anything about it. I think they're feeling pressure, and they don't want to be unfriendly, and they don't want to help, either. So I'll have to deal with that later, but meanwhile, I've got a friend up in the cloisters who says she heard someone up there mention that we are ripe."
"Ripe?"
"Ripe for development."
"Real estate?"
Jen said. "As always, right? I mean, when is it not real estate?"
"But in the intertidal?"
"The intertidal is ripe. That's what they're saying. It's got problems, it's been a mess, but people have dealt with it, and now we've got it going. So now Uptown wants to take it over again. It's like, renovation's over, time to flip.
But you've got to own before you can sell.
Right.
But what about the legal questions? No one is supposed to be able to own the intertidal.
Possession is 9/10 of the law, right? Then again, the buying hasn't been going that well. And maybe that's part of it. There's been a lot of resistance. Hardly anyone wants to sell to these assholes, even at prices you'd think would work. A lot of money is being offered. I heard $10,000 a square foot for some buildings. But, you know, if you like the water, you can only get that in the water. Doesn't matter how much money is offered to limpets like that. So the assholes offer more, until it's crazy time. And then you can see that the offers are a threat, right? Like, take our mad money and make a bundle, or else. If you don't, then it's your fault. You're not playing the game. Bad things can happen to you if you don't play the game, and it's your fault for not playing.
This is happening to you,
Jen said. Sure it is. It's happening to everyone in the drink. New York is New York, Jen. People want this place, drowned or not.
Mildew, Jen suggested.
Venice has mildew, and people still want Venice. And this is the Super Venice.
So they're selling defective goods to make you look bad.
That's what it looks like to me. It's not my friends doing it, that's for sure. We take good care of our own. Everything people need has been tested, and most of it is made or grown underwater. I know I'm not telling you anything you didn't already know, right?
Jen nodded. That's why I came by to ask you what was up. It was weird.
It is weird. They sat there looking at each other, two powerful figures in lower Manhattan. But no one was capable of withstanding pressure from uptown on their own. It took a team effort. This was the look on Ellie's fashionable face, now looking kind of drawn and strung out. Jen could only nod. Ellie smiled a tight smile. When we heard you were coming by, there were those who wanted me to ask you if you'd go in the ring again. Bets are being late already.
Jen shook her head. I've retired, you know that. I'm too old.
Ellie's smile got a little friendlier. So, some bets have already lost.
And some have won. I'll come watch with you. Always enjoy seeing a match or two.
Okay, better than nothing. They'll enjoy having the champ on hand.
The old champ.
Please quit reminding me. I'm older than you.
By a month, right?
That's right.
Ellie got up and went to the door, spoke to someone.
Jen gestured at Ezra and Claire, still knocking around the same number of balls on the table. They had not misspent their youths, that was clear. Screen kids for sure. Could not handle the third dimension. Shit at ping pong too, Jen presumed.
You've got to attend to the sixth dimension, she told them.
But that was Sean's thing, and they didn't get it.
I'm going to watch some water sumo, Jen told them. Come along and keep an eye on the audience in there. Don't get distracted. See if you see anyone watching Ellie during the match, watching her, rather than the action in the pool. They nodded.
Ellie returned and led them along a long hallway to a stairwell leading down. They took flights of these stairs down until they were far under the city streets, maybe 70 feet below low tide, in an aerated portion of old subway tunnel. Old tunnel walls and bulkheads, heavily coated with diamond spray, held out the subterranean waters. These chambers were called diamond balloons or diamond caves and could be quite extensive. The diamond sheeting was all that was keeping them dry, that and the hard old bedrock of the island itself. They came into a big bright chamber that had a gleaming round turquoise pool cut down into its center, lighting the room like a blue lava lamp. A New York bathhouse, sure. Another nostalgia trip, like the speakeasy. Same idea. The main pool was a hot tub in Icelandic Blue Lagoon style, with different parts of it bubbling at different temperatures. A
a place for people to hang out in hot water and drink and talk. All very familiar to Jen. She had spent a lot of hours in rings like this one, but it had been so long ago that she had outlived nostalgia itself, it seemed, and felt no desire to get back in the ring. Her knees ached at the thought, and sometimes she had trouble catching her breath even in the open air. No, it was a kid's game, as so many of them were. The crowd was arriving from other rooms and other pools, many of them in bathing attire, or non-attire, and wet already. Jen sat by Ellie and enjoyed the vibe, the friendly hellos. Oh, she's back! Coming back to mama. That kind of thing. Please, Jen, get back in! No way, she said. Show me what you got. I'm taking even money here. They'll be here in a second, Ellie said to Jen. Jen nodded. Anyone I know? I doubt it. Youngsters. Ginger and Diane. Okay, fine. But look, afterward, it'll get all social, and we won't want to go back to business. But I want you to find out who's horning in on you, okay? I'm trying, Ellie complained. I'd like to know myself. So, maybe keep an eye out for a security company called Pincher Pinkerton. Ellie's eyebrows rose. You think? I wonder. That's interesting, because someone else was talking about them. That is interesting. Look to it. Then two young women came in, already wet in two-piece bathing suits, red and blue. Both women substantial and curvy, and the crowd oohed and awed. People were coming in from other rooms, and this one quickly filled. The wrestlers entered the central ring in the pool. They were nice and friendly as they shook hands. The crowd settled down around the pool in short risers and just sitting or standing on the decks. Many were of indeterminate gender, wearing flamboyant water dress or undress. Lots of intergender in the intertidal. Inter, as such, was a big thing now. Ambiguity, a definite style, which, like all styles, like to see and be seen. The big low chamber, now lit entirely by the pool lights, was in fact turning into quite a Delanidon, such that it was best not to look too closely at what was happening in the corners. But everyone was really friendly. This was the norm at Ellie's, or in any speakeasy bathhouse, so Jen found it all familiar and reassuring. Ezra and Claire were looking a little round-eyed. They were clearly not denizens of the deep like Jen had once been, but they were well-positioned to scan the crowd to see if Ellie was being watched. The ref asked if Jen would preside. This was mostly a ceremonial position, as the tosses were ultimately determined by laser and camera, so she agreed and stood to a little smattering of applause and hooting. She spanked the water to warn the two wrestlers it was time. They ducked their heads under and came up looking gorgeous. The Diane looked like a shot putter, brown-skinned and solid. The Ginger looked more Mediterranean and seemed like a water polo player. In many respects, water sumo resembled the legwork part of water polo, although in truth, it was considerably less vicious than that. They met in the center of the pool and waited for the cheers and encouragements to subside. Jen took the wand from Sai, the usual ref, who was wearing a red eye patch tonight, and clicked it to turn on the light. A cylinder of laser red shot from the ceiling straight into the pool, tangible in both the humid air and the water, very vividly marking a red circle on the floor of the pool. This lit circle and cylinder was the sumo line. Whoever got shoved completely outside it lost. A simple old game imported from Japan to the bathhouses of New York many decades before. Jen had been a champion in her time, and she felt a little ghost of the buzz as she watched the two wrestlers settle in. She said to them, "No poking or pinching or punching or grabbing the face, ladies. You know the rules. Keep it sumo clean so I don't have to call you on anything. We'll go three tosses to the win, and if it goes to la belle, I'll remind you of that.
The two women stood about chest deep in water. 4 feet was still standard. Jen said, "Go," and they approached each other, shook hands, moved back. Then Ginger ducked down, and Diane did the same. In some forms of the game, you had to keep your head above water. But full immersion had become standard back in Jen's time. So now these two had sucked air and were down there looking at each other underwater. A whiff of heated chlorine in the air, people quiet and watching the action below, like a visit to an aquarium. The Ginger made the first attack, and Diane planted her feet on the pool floor and leaned into it. Young Ginger bounced right off her, and Diane went after her. Ginger planted her feet to counter-push, so Diane twisted aside and took her opponent's momentum and pulled her by the waist and butt. Ginger was thrown out of the circle, and Jen called the toss to cheers. One throw. After that, the two settled in and worked harder. Ginger kept her head above water. Diane did the same. They mirrored each other for a good long while, trying to frustrate each other. But being one throw down, Ginger had gotten conservative, and she appeared to be faster. In the end, it was Diane who got impatient first, and with a quick wrist grab and pull, Ginger got her moving and then escorted her out by a kick to the butt. People love to see women fight. Jen liked it herself. Now it was 1-1, and the smaller one faster than the heavier one. Of course that was the way it would be. So at that point, the Diane resorted to the frog. This was what Jen would have done in her own good youth. Go to the bottom and shove around down there, wedge under the other, and push up as well as out. Very effective if you could hold your breath long enough and keep your balance when frogged in a low crouch, which this Diane could do. She managed to grab the Ginger by the ankles and spin her like a discus out of the circle. That made Ginger very nervous, and when they began again, she went on the attack right away. But sumo was about mass staying put, so defense was always king and queen too. And it didn't take long for Diane to slip to the side, go deep again, wedge under, and shove off the bottom and catch Ginger right in the midriff and carry her out. Ginger just clearing the circle before Diane did, by about a foot, Jen judged, the left foot, and the cameras confirmed it. Match to Diane. Both of them stood and shook hands, first with each other and then with Jen, and Jen was pleased to see they were happy to have her there. Indeed, everyone there loved having a policewoman, the famous submarine inspector, there in a private bathhouse, reffing the action. Just like up in the air, if things were going well.
Last of ebb and daylight waning. Scented sea-cool landward making, smells of sedge and salt incoming, with many a half-caught voice sent up from the eddies, many a muffled confession, many a sob and whispered word, as of speakers far or hid. Walt Whitman.
F. Mutt and Jeff. Jeff, are you okay?
I'm not okay. How could I be okay? We're in prison. We got ourselves lost in a prison of our own devise. Meaning me, I mean. I'm so sorry I got you mixed up with this, Mutt. I'm really sorry. I apologize.
Don't worry about that. Eat your breakfast here.
Is it morning, do you think?
It's pancakes. Just eat it.
I can't eat right now. I'm sick to my stomach. I'm nauseous.
But you didn't eat anything yesterday, either. Or the day before, if I'm not mistaken. Aren't you hungry? You should be hungry.
I'm hungry, but I'm so sick I'm not hungry. I can't eat right now.
Well, drink something then. Here, just a little water. I'm going to mix a little maple syrup into this water, see? It'll taste good, and it'll go down easy.
Don't. You'll make me sick.
No, I won't. Just try it. You'll see. You need the sugar in you. You're getting weak. I mean, here you are apologizing. It's a bad sign. It's not like you. Jeff shakes his head. Pale, bearded face on a stained pillow,
flecks of spittle at the corners of his mouth. I got you into this. I should have asked you what you thought before I did anything. Yes, you should. But now, that is neither here nor there. Now you need to drink something, then eat something. You need to stay strong so we can get through this thing. So, better you retain your convictions right now, because I need you. Jeff sips some water, maybe a tablespoon of it. Some of it drips down into his beard. Mutt wipes his chin with a napkin. More, Mutt says. Drink more. When you're hydrated, you'll feel hungry. Jeff nods, sips more. Mutt is spooning water into his mouth. After this works for a while, he dips the spoon into the little waxed box of maple syrup and feeds Jeff some of that. Jeff chokes a little, nods, sits up, and takes in several more spoonfuls of maple syrup. That's good, he says. Now more water. He sits up in his bed, leans his head and shoulders against the wall. He eats a few tiny bites of pancake dipped in maple syrup, chokes a little, shakes his head at the offer of more. Mutt shifts back to water. After a while, Jeff holds a glass of water on his stomach, raises it to sip by himself.
I can feel the water behind this wall, he says. I can feel it move. Well, maybe I'm hearing it. I wonder what that's about. I guess sound is strange underwater. It carries farther, or has more force or something.
I don't know. How about some more pancakes?
No, quit it. You're hectoring me.
I see you must be feeling better.
Did Hector hector people?
I somehow think he's getting a bad rap with this word. Someone comes and lays siege to his city, tries to kill everyone in it. He organizes and leads the resistance to that, gets killed, and his body dragged around by the heels, and his name becomes the verb for harassing someone? How is that fair?
Harassing someone to do the right thing, Mutt suggests.
Nevertheless, he's been screwed. Pander deserved what he got, but Hector? No. And how come the real jerks got away there? How come you don't pull an Achilles when you stalk off in a snit? Prima donnas, we call them, but prima donnas were Boy Scouts compared to him. Or how about you Ajax that one? I definitely Ajaxed that trap I tried. Sorry again about that. But okay, I'll defer the sorries until later. Fucking Ajaxed it big time. Or fucking Zeus. Someone flies into a narcissistic rage? Do we say he's Zeusing out? No, we don't. No Ulysses-izing a situation. No Agamemnoning.
You're a pretty great Cassandra, Mutt mentions.
See, I knew you read more than the R handbook.
Not really. It's just stuff you pick up by reading crap in the cloud.
Now Jeff's rant sinks into a hoarse whisper. He's fading in and out, it looks like.
Crap in the cloud. A novel of celestial sewage. I could have written that one myself. Been down so long, it looks like up to me. What I should have done is hold my horses and wait until something could have done some good. I definitely screwed that up, and I'm sorry. I'll apologize later. I hope you know I only did it because I couldn't stand it anymore. Here we are in this beautiful world, if we're not dead and in limbo, and they were ripping our heads off, pretending there were shortages and terrorists and pitting us against each other while they took 99% of everything. Immiserate the same people who keep you alive. Which god or idiot did that in Homer? None of them. They're worse than the worst gods in Homer. That's what they're doing, Mutt. I can't stand it.
I know.
Because it's bad.
I know. Don't worry about it right now, though. You have to conserve your energy right now. Don't enumerate the crimes of the ruling class, please. I know them already. You need to save your strength. Are you hungry?
I'm sick. I'm sick of those bastards ripping us off, tooling to Davos to tell each other how great they are, how much good they're doing. Fucking fuckwad hypocrites and bastards. And they get away with it.
Jeff, stop now. Stop. You're wasting your energy on this. You're preaching to the choir on this. I agree already, so there's no point in saying it all over again. The world is fucked up.
Agreed.
The rich are stupid assholes.
Agreed.
But you need to stop saying so. I can't. I know. But you have to. Just this time. Save it for later. I can't. I try, but I can't. Fucking.
Happily, Jeff falls asleep. Mutt tries to truck a last spoonful of maple water in the corner of his mouth, then wipes his chin again and pulls the blanket up over his chest. He sits on the chair by the bed, rocking back and forth a little. Finally, he takes one of the plates from the serving tray and cleans it until it is a smooth, round, white circle of ceramic. On this, he writes using one of the little packets of strawberry jam. My friend is sick. He needs a doctor right now.
The skyscrapers seem like tall gravestones. José M. Irizarry Rodríguez. There are ghosts in New York. Someday, I'll be one of them, said Fred Goodman.
G. Stefan and Roberto. Stefan and Roberto were glad to see the old man settled into the Met Towers farm. It seemed like a better place for him than his moldering squat, especially now that that building was on its last tilt into the tide. He himself didn't agree, and was frantic to get his stuff back, especially the maps. This they could well understand, and they spent the next couple of days boating over to the old wreck and venturing in trepidatiously to recover them. Once those were back in Mr. Hexter's hands, he was so grateful he asked them to go back for more stuff. Turned out he cherished quite a few things that would be inconvenient, if not impossible, to move on their boat, like the map cabinet. But there were some items on his list that they could move, so they risked more trips over there. Each one exposed them to a possible bust by the water police, who supposedly wanted people to stay out of the collapse zone. But Mr. Hexter promised he would bail them out if they got busted, buy them a boat, claim to be their teacher, adopt them, whatever it took. He didn't seem to understand that there were situations where he wouldn't be able to help them. To support the cover story that he was their teacher, he gave them a little wrist pad that had some audiobooks on it, like a million, and a moldy book copy of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn by a Mark Twain. He told them to listen to the book while looking at the pages, and that would teach them to read, as long as they learned their ABCs, so that the words on the page were not just funny shapes, but marks for sounds. He swore the method would work, so the boys tried it while in their boat under the dock at night, looking at the pages by flashlight for as long as they could stand it while listening to the words, which lit up as they were being said, after which they gave up and just listened ahead in the story. An interesting story. Hokey, but fun. They, too, had been hungry and stolen food. They, too, had been threatened and once or twice trapped and abused by adults. It was strange to be hearing a story about that stuff. The next night, they would shift backward in the audio and find the page where they had stopped reading and look for a time while listening again. Fairly quickly, they began to see what the old man meant. It was a pretty simple system, although the spelling was often strangely wrong. They got to know Huck's story well, and enjoyed discussing it as they cross-stitched their way forward. Wild times on the Mississippi. Similar in many ways to life on the Hudson. Meanwhile, by day, they were boating across town once a day to recover Mr. Hexter's books, heavy, clothes, moldy, and rubber boots, stinky. Vlade knew now that they slept in their boat under his dock, and he often gave them food, also a free charge for their boat's battery, so they could gurgle over to the wreck rather than row, always taking canals not cordoned off by the water police. Everyone said the three remaining towers there would also fall. They had to stay south of that whole neighborhood for as long as they could, then cut up to it. Then one day they burbled up to the building and found that it had slumped even farther to the side. Man, it's like Pap's houseboat in the Mississippi. I don't think that was his houseboat, said Roberto. I think Jim and Huck just found him in it. Only Jim found him. He told Huck about it later. Yeah, I know. But why was Pap there if it wasn't his? I don't know. I don't think we've been told. Maybe later in the story. Maybe. Meanwhile, we got a problem here. We got to tell the old man the place is too dangerous. But is it? I think we should take a look and see.